Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science, across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today is somebody I've admired for a long time. He's been a colleague, but he's also an inspiration. My guest today is Dr. Robert McGeed. Rob, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Thank you, Ross. It is such an honor and a privilege for me to participate and to be able to share my thoughts with you. And I think of myself as a person, as a parent, as a child, as a sibling, and as a spouse. And I'm also fortunate to be a thoracic surgeon and have a career in a treatment of patients, predominantly cancer patients, with cancers that have spread to the chest or come from the chest.
Excellent. All right. So we'll dive into, you know, the beginning. So McGeed is M-E-G-U-I-D. So tell me who your parents were, where you were born and brought up.
Yeah. I was born in Boston and was raised in Boston and then Los Angeles and then upstate New York and then embarked on my journey in academia and went to college and med school at Brown University in Rhode Island, and then did my surgical general surgery training at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, followed by my cardiothoracic surgical fellowship at the University of Washington in Seattle. And so I've had the delight of living all over the U.S. I'm a first-generation American. My parents met in medical school in London in the 1960s. My father hails from Cairo, Egypt, and my mother from the south of England. And after they met and proceeded through their medical school training and initial house officer years in London, they then emigrated to the United States to do their residencies. My mother at Boston Children's Hospital in pediatrics, and my father in general surgery, initially at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and subsequently at Boston City Hospital, or Boston University Hospital as it's known now. And then my family, my sibling, my sister and I were born in Boston in the 1970s. And then, like I said, lived around the U.S. in various parts as my parents traveled and their careers progressed.
Yeah. So I never asked you this before. How did your dad end up from Cairo in London?
Yeah, he has an incredible story. He was born in Cairo to an Egyptian father and a German mother during World War II. And then when he was a young child, he lived part of the time in post-World War II Germany outside of Hamburg, being raised by his grandparents, while his father was doing his second PhD in England, of all places. And then he moved back to Egypt and was in Egypt briefly until his father unfortunately died while working for the United Nations in Lebanon. My father then went to England for his grammar school and high school years, and then matriculated to medical school in England, where he met my mother. And then he stayed in England, and then they immigrated to the U.S., like I said, in the 1960s. And so, and in fact, my parents' story is quite interesting, and my father's just published, self-published his fourth book on his life of growing up and going through medicine like that. Anyway,
wow,
that's been a career for him after he ceased being a practicing surgeon.
And so you have an older sister, yeah. And so you grew up in a very medical family. Mom's a pediatrician, dad's a surgeon, and he was an academic surgeon too.
They're both academic. Yeah, both my parents are academic physicians, and my father has a PhD as well as being a doctor in medicine, and ran a basic science lab on surgical nutrition and metabolism. And he's a cancer surgeon and noticed his cancer patients being cachectic, losing muscle and weight, and spent his career, in addition to being a surgeon, but also running the nutrition service at the hospitals where he worked and doing research on postoperative surgical nutrition, which was my first foray into research. As a child, I was intrigued by science and the quantitative sciences like math and biology and chemistry, and was intrigued by my parents sharing their stories about the patients they were caring for. And it was really exciting as a child to learn that you could make such an impressive impact on someone's life as a physician, which really prompted me, spurred me on to an interest in science and in medicine. And in the summers, when I was in high school, I would work in my father's lab, initially a basic science lab, initially washing bottles and dishes.
The cheapest labor.
Yeah, it was volunteer, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was absolutely intrigued by the science going on around me. And he and the scientists in his lab incorporated me into their work. And I got to participate in research starting as a high school student, where I started to learn about the scientific method and be engaged in research, which really spurred my lifelong interest in impactful research that helps nowadays, that is aimed at helping people recover from surgery and do better in their lives.
So when you were in high school, this is when you're upstate New York at this point?
Yeah.
Syracuse. Okay. And your dad was a general surgeon? He was a cancer surgeon?
He was a general surgeon, but he ran the breast surgery clinic and was largely treating patients with breast cancer. And he did surgical oncology in the abdomen. So he was a busy clinical surgeon, took trauma call as well as many surgeons in non-super specialized environments do.
And you said you watched him operate. That's got to be pretty cool, watching your dad actually do some miraculous stuff when you're a kid.
It was cool. I actually wasn't as enthralled about watching my dad do it as I was just about watching it.
Okay. It was just like anyone doing it. It was cool.
It was amazing to see. The coincidence was my mom and my sister were busy out of town maybe. And my dad was watching me, but he was on call, and he got called in to treat a patient who had cholecystitis and inflamed gallbladder. And he said, well, what am I going to do with my maybe nine-year-old son? I was nine at the time. What am I going to do with my nine-year-old son? So he brought me with him. And also, these are slightly different ages, eras when we could bring kids into the hospital pre-pandemic. And then he was pandemic. And so he sat me, he had me put on scrubs, the smallest pair he could find, and he sat me in the corner of the operating room with a book. And I didn't want to look at my book at all. I wanted to stand up and watch the operation. So I'm wearing a mask and all that. And so I'm standing a few feet behind people and standing on some step stools, looking over his or the nurse's or the resident's shoulders into the operating field to see what the operation was. And it was fascinating, really fascinating, and piqued one's interest at an early age.
That's incredible. And your sister didn't get the bug. She didn't get the medicine bug.
No, she is an incredibly smart and hardworking woman. And she is a political scientist at the University of Rochester. And she teaches classes in political science to undergraduate and graduate students. And then she also engages in research. So we all got the science bug, but hers is political science, not human science.
And okay, so one of the things we talked about, and this is a recurring theme, is, you know, medicine is a very demanding career. And some people, you know, who've had doctors in the family are saying, like, well, I don't want to do that because that looks like too much like hard work. Or, you know, there's a kind of rationing of time with a parent who's a physician. And I mean, you had two doctors as parents, so that's got to be tough.
Yeah, my parents made every effort they could to be engaged parents with their kids. My mother actually put her clinical and academic career on hiatus to raise my sister and myself. And knowing that my father was in the OR or in the lab or in clinic a significant amount of time, my fascination with the science obviously outweighed my aversion to the hard work and long hours. And especially in training all of medicine and training medical school residencies, regardless of your discipline in medicine, are incredibly long hours, and it's intentional so that you become proficient at what you're doing when you're treating people. But I did make a lot of mental notes about what I wanted for my family and what level of engagement I wanted to be able to have. And it's a challenge. It's a constant challenge to make sure I'm home to see family. Last night, I got home at 9:30, close to 10 o'clock last night after operating all day and seeing my patients. And I was able to see my kids briefly before they went to bed. But I know that when I've got free time on the weekends, when I'm not on call, I absolutely spend as much time as I can with them and prioritize the time together so that it's high quality time, so that we can continue to have our relationship grow between myself and my kids and myself and my wife.
How old are your kids, man?
My daughter's 12, my son is 9.
God. Yeah. It's a good time because they still like having you around.
And I tell you, despite all the training we get to be a physician and for me a surgeon, we only get passive training to be a parent. And it's really a challenge for all of us, I think all humans, to be a really engaged parent. And some people are better than others, and it's an active process. It's not a passive process.
It is. I have a friend of mine, and this is going slightly off piece, but I just want to share it with you. And he's a very committed academic, and he always gets slightly frustrated when people say, you know, what is your greatest achievement? And everyone always says their kids. And he says, well, I love my kids, but they're not the only achievement I've ever made. And it's politically incorrect to say that, but I love my job and I love the discoveries I've made.
Yeah. I think you and he had said it well. I love my kids and I'm incredibly proud of them and their achievements to date at their young age. And I have only the hopes that they have amazing and better achievements and go on to be phenomenal people and contributing to society and happy. And I'm similarly proud of all the patient care delivery I've done and the research that I've done. And, you know, it would be hard for me to say I favor one over the other.
Now, your medical training, you went straight into medical training or fast track, sort of guaranteed you medical school. Can you explain that?
Yes. During high school, when I was looking at universities, some universities have a combined undergraduate medical school track. And so when you're applying from high school into university, if you match into that, it sort of guarantees you a spot proceeding to medicine, as you obviously have to maintain certain standards of academics and core curriculum that you take. And I did that at Brown University. So when I was in high school and applying to Brown University, I applied to the program in liberal medical education, which is a combined 8-year program. It's intentionally not shortened so that they can help develop well-rounded physicians. So it didn't shorten any time. I did my 4 years of undergraduate. I actually majored in chemistry, because they didn't have molecular biology at the time, which I would have chosen. And I had a minor concentration in art history.
Nice.
Then I actually took a year off between college and medical school, did some work and some research and did some travel and matured a little bit and proved to myself that I could earn a living, and then went back to medical school. So I didn't actually shorten it. I actually lengthened it. And at that program at that time, there wasn't a lot of crossover between the preclinical and clinical medical school years and the undergraduate years.
And then why Brown?
I couldn't be happier in retrospect, with my decision for Brown. I loved it at the time, and I still am very pleased and fortunate that I was able to go there. I was intrigued and learned about it because my sister, who was 2 years ahead of me and a valedictorian of her high school class, was fortunate to be accepted to Brown and go there. And I visited her when she was an undergraduate several times while I was still in high school. And I was just in awe of the academic environment, the diversity of the students, the faculty, and what I saw directly through my sister and her colleagues as the high quality education and stimulating environment. And so I dreamed, therefore, of going there and was really fortunate to be able to match there for college and med school too.
When you come to the end of med school,
yeah,
I mean, you've had, you know, this I mean, incredible formative experience, you know, being exposed to surgery. Did you think you wanted to be a surgeon even when you were going through med school?
I did. And it has always had a strong appeal to me for many reasons, and those reasons have evolved over the course of my career, but I always had a strong interest in it. And obviously that was primed by the exposure I had to my father, who was a surgeon. However, knowing the challenges of being a surgeon and having a practice and balancing life, I tried to make sure that none of the other disciplines were in medicine were as appealing to me or as good a fit. And I enjoyed most of the rotations I did. There were some that just really weren't for me. Thank goodness there are people who enjoy that and can do those as their careers. But I really enjoyed surgery. I enjoyed the hands-on aspect. I enjoyed the ability to immediately impact a patient's life. I enjoyed the short-term impact and the long-term impact from longitudinal patient care. I enjoyed the perioperative care inside the operating room, outside the operating room. So it checked a lot of boxes on my satisfaction from a career perspective. I really enjoyed primary care and medicine. I enjoyed pediatrics, but I gravitated more towards the interventional specialties where I could use my hands to do. You know, I liked to make things with Lego when I was a kid and build models when I was a kid, and that translated well into my ability to use my hands to impact patients' outcomes.
So you go through medical school, and then for those of us who aren't surgeons, can you explain surgical training? I mean, would you go straight into a residency? How does it work?
Yeah. So surgical training is a very traditional programmatic training in the United States that's existed since the 1920s. And you have a first year of residency called internship, which is in general surgery internship. You do a broad spectrum of surgical specialties and you spend a lot of time learning about patient care and not as much time doing those operations, but you get exposure to the patient care and you get exposure to clinic and management in some surgeries. And you also do a fair amount of watching of the senior residents operating with the faculty members, and you learn a lot by watching. And then after that, there's a 4-year training on top of internship, which is dedicated to acquiring the technical skills. The second year of training programs in most of the programs in this country is largely revolves around being in the intensive care unit and taking care of critically ill patients, as well as operating. And then in your 4th year and your 5th year of residency, the focus is on you leading the team, making the patient care decisions. You vet them with the faculty who are responsible for the patient, but you have a lot more autonomy and mature throughout that process, and then learning operative skills at the same time.
Is it as traditional as like C1, D1, Teach 1? I mean, does someone go, Rob, do you want to do the thoracotomy today? I mean, how does it work?
It's not quite as straightforward as C1, Teach 1, D1. It's a graduated apprenticeship where you're doing a little bit more and more of each operation and given a little more and more autonomy. And as you demonstrate your competence, the surgeons typically let you do a little bit more and guide you through it and are a little more hands-off as you develop that skill set. And that's the same with the actual patient management, where it's initially very hands-on from a patient care perspective, and then progressively more and more autonomy with the patient care.
Do you remember key operations, like the first time you did X or Y?
I do. I remember my very first operation as a medical student where I was given the scalpel. The attending surgeon invited me to take a scalpel to make the incision. And it was quite a simple operation with hindsight. It was excision of a keloid scar on a young lady's chest.
Okay.
By one of the plastic surgeons. But it was undeniably formative. The first time I'd used a knife to cut through a living person's skin.
Wow. Yeah, I should tell you, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I faint at the sight of blood in operating rooms, and I've never actually seen a complete operation without being unconscious. Which is why I ended up in my specialty, not yours. Does that happen to surgeons, or you're just like so in the moment?
It can. I actually fainted as a medical student.
Oh,
watching like,
you're making me feel better now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very unusual environment. It's quite claustrophobic. You've got a mask on, which before the pandemic, we didn't wear masks all the time.
Yeah.
It's can be often warm. There are strange smells and noises.
Yeah.
It's a lot going on. There's often a lot of people in an operating room and it can be disorienting. And that's why, like much of medicine, it's a graduated experience. You don't just start out doing something really complex, because it's not only the operation, it's all the things around it, the situational awareness that you develop and the environment that you become used to.
And then, you know, the stereotype of the surgeon, we'll get into your more senior training in a second, but the stereotype of the surgeon is, you know, the sort of prima donna who throws things and shouts. And maybe that's only in the movies, but, you know, do they exist in the real world?
Yeah, you think that would only be 4-year-old kids. But I've seen some of them exist and still some that exist. And a lot has changed in my limited lifetime in surgery from when I was a medical student. I graduated medical school in 2002. So since then, a lot has changed, even since I was in med school, where some of the behavior that was permissive behavior and that people engaged in is no longer tolerated, thankfully. And I consider the environment to be much more collegial. I don't think that's just colloquial to where I am. I think that's more ubiquitous nationally, where some behavior is no longer tolerated, thankfully. And there's a much more congenial environment in the operating room where, for instance, in my operating room, I want everyone on a first name basis. I want to be able to communicate with everyone on a first name basis. I don't want the perception of pedigree or stature to limit safety communications, for instance. I want feedback and conversation with the anesthesiology team. In my discipline as a thoracic surgeon, I interact with the anesthesiologists constantly throughout the operation. I don't want them to have a barrier to communication with a drape that separates us. I want to see them eye to eye. I want the nurses to feel comfortable speaking up. I love it when the nurses have suggestions for things that will potentially improve the operation that the surgeons maybe didn't think of.
So you finish medical school, you decide you want to go into surgical training. Where do you go and how do you decide that's the place?
Yeah. So during medical school, at the end of medical school, as it's wrapping up, you start thinking about where to apply for training. And it's a national program that you apply through and you go to programs and interview face to face with them and they rank you and you rank them. And a computer algorithm spits out the best fit for all the trainees in the United States. And I started by doing away sub-internships where I would go to other institutions and spend a month in that institution as an acting intern, as a medical student who's visiting on one of the surgical services. You're given the day-to-day responsibilities that are akin to the intern. You're asked to function like an intern. You interact with the faculty. You watch the operations. You participate as best you can. And part of it is for you to see how you fit with them and parts for them to see how they fit with you. It's like dating. And so I did two sub-internships at my home institution at Brown University at two different hospitals. I did a sub-internship at the Brigham and Women's Hospital where my father had gone to residency and my mother, and I'm from Boston. I wanted to see if I wanted to be back in that area. I did a sub-internship at the University of Louisville in Kentucky because it is an outstanding training program and the surgeons I met from there were amazing. And then I also did a sub-internship at Johns Hopkins Hospital because it has a reputation for being an excellent training program. And having talked to colleagues around the country, I did these sub-internships and I found there were pros and cons of all of them and better and worse fit at different places. Then I applied. I then went to interview at a dozen or so places around the country. I submitted my rank list where I list the programs I interviewed at in my rank order, and they did the same for me and all the other candidates to interview. The match algorithm happens, National Residency Match Program, NRMP. You get this letter in your school mailbox at the School of Medicine and on match day, and everyone opens it up and there's cheers and there's groans and media and photos. And it's like, well, where are you going next year? Well, I'm going to Johns Hopkins Hospital for general surgery residency. I was admitted as a categorical resident, so it means I got to do all my internship and my four subsequent years consecutively at the one institution. I couldn't have been happier. Amazing feeling that day.
I see that it was called a Halsted residency. Is that Is that different? I mean, is that an honorific or just Johns Hopkins likes to give itself names?
They like to give themselves names. William Stuart Halsted was one of the preeminent surgeons around the turn of the century in the United States and in the world. And he founded the modern version of the surgical residency in the U.S. based on the template he and other astute physicians came up with. And so traditionally, the general surgery residency at Johns Hopkins is called the Halsted residency.
Got it. Okay. And so you go through general surgical training.
Yes.
Now, your dad, as you said, was a general surgeon that had some interest in, you know, breast cancer, some abdominal surgery. How do you start to figure out if you want to be a general surgeon and, you know, work in the boonies, or you want to be more specialist?
Yeah. So I approached it with the thought of, let's see what I learn and get exposed to. I had enjoyed colorectal surgery because I had some exposure to that as a medical student. and really started to enjoy my interactions with cancer patients through that discipline. I had enjoyed trauma surgery because it's fun, because you get to do a lot of activity and things as a med student. And then during my residency, I rotated on different rotations. And I started out, actually, my first day of residency was on the surgical oncology service, which was hepatobiliary surgery and pancreatic surgery and colon surgery and some endocrine surgery. And the cancer surgery immediately caught my attention. Really found a great deal of enjoyment with taking care of the patients with cancer, and worked with some phenomenal and well-renowned surgeons who have been formative in my career and in American surgery, and was incredibly fortunate to have that exposure. And then rotated through other services with similar faculty and getting to know their what their love of their discipline was. And as I went through this, I started to realize I really like taking care of cancer patients. I find it really satisfying and an impact I can make on their lives that I wouldn't be able to otherwise. During my residency, I opted to take 3 years out. Commonly at academic residency programs, trainees take between 1 and 3 years out of training, from the clinical training, to do research. And I worked with Dr. Stephen Leach, who is a pancreatic cancer surgeon and researcher, and at the time was at Johns Hopkins, and I worked in his basic science lab, developing transgenic mice lines who could develop pancreatic cancer, and they also did zebrafish studies on pancreatic cancer at the same time. And it was really exciting and eye-opening. But by the time I got to that, I had done 3 years of clinical residency, and I had a brief rotation on the thoracic surgery service at Johns Hopkins, and found a few things that were amazing. I was intrigued by the ability to do thoracic surgery, which is a combination of cancer surgery and non-cancer surgery. I loved the limited dimensions of the chest, where I could become an expert in a smaller field rather than a master of everything in the body, as many surgical oncologists need to be. And I found some of the most incredible mentors I've had in my life. On top of the great mentors I've had and been fortunate to have, I worked with a handful, a very small group of thoracic surgeons who each imparted incredible things that I feel fortunate to have learned from. Stephen Yang was a chief of thoracic surgery at the time and is still, all of these are still surgeons, these guys. And he was incredible to work with and really turned me on to thoracic oncology. Malcolm Brock is a thoracic surgeon who's a really incredible researcher engaged in a combination of health services research and basic science work. And I spent time with him doing research as well. And I've always loved the mentorship he provided me and the thoughts he gave me. Mark Sussman was a cardiac surgeon who retooled to be a thoracic surgeon and really showed me the breadth and depth of thoracic surgery. And then Lynn Skariak was a thoracic surgeon who also just showed me what thoracic surgery practice was like. And these surgeons really took me under their wing. And between my interest in what they were doing and their interest in me, it was a love affair of a career in the making.
So you touched on the cardiothoracic element. So I think this sometimes confuses people, because the board certification is in cardiothoracic surgery. Yes. And these same people going through that training are going to end up doing, coronary artery bypass grafts and things like that. So was that part of your training?
It was. So after 3 years in the lab, where I ended up doing a master in public health and falling in love with health services, outcomes, and surgical epidemiologic research, and retooling my brain for that type of research instead of basic science research, I then did my last 2 years in general surgery. And then after that, applied in the same match process with the same interview process to cardiothoracic surgery fellowships. They're actually officially called thoracic residencies, but it's cardiothoracic surgery and it's a fellowship. And they range from 2 to 3 years in length. And I looked at numerous ones across the country and fell in love with and was fortunate to match at the University of Washington in Seattle, where indeed I did a combination 50% cardiac surgery training and 50% thoracic surgery training. And so in my training, I had the pleasure and privilege of doing a lot of heart surgery, aortic valve replacements, mitral valve repairs and replacements, coronary artery bypasses, aortic surgery, and enjoyed it from a technical perspective, but really kept coming back to my love of thoracic oncology.
And then, is there a separate thoracic, I don't know, qualification or something like that? Or is it just you personally decide that I'm qualified in both, but I'm going to call myself a thoracic surgeon?
Yeah, that is correct. There are tracks at some institutions where they give you a little heavier training in one versus the other based on your interest, like we do here in our training program. But in my training, there was not a tracking, and we were pluripotent stem cells that could go off to be cardiac surgeons or thoracic surgeons or cardiothoracic private practice surgeons, or go into a congenital cardiac fellowship to be a pediatric heart surgeon on top of that. And my interest in thoracic surgery and thoracic oncology always kept me aimed at the target of being a thoracic surgeon.
And there's two things about the Hopkins time that I want to touch on. So one is my favorite story you told me about Cheryl and about how you met her. Cheryl, who is now your wife?
My wife is coming on 20 years. Cheryl and I met, so my first night on call, July 4, 2022. My first night on call as an intern covering...
2002, I imagine.
Thank you, 2002. Yeah. I made that mistake before. So covering numerous surgical services, inpatient, I can't leave the hospital. I'm stuck in the hospital taking care of sick patients. And it is a very stressful event because I'm learning where the bathrooms are, and I'm learning who Mr. Smith is and who Mrs. Jones is, and figuring out how to take care of them and what their problems are. And I'm running around the hospital like a headless chicken. And night falls, and in Baltimore, there's fireworks in the Inner Harbor. And if you were in the right rooms of the hospital at Johns Hopkins, you can see towards the Inner Harbor and see glimpses of the fireworks between the buildings. So I don't know if someone suggested it, or I end up going into a patient's room and watching the fireworks from the bathroom of that patient's room, because I could see them. And there's this beautiful young lady standing next to me. We start chatting. She's a nursing student. She's a technician there to get some nursing experience. Her name is Cheryl. We started chatting, and I was a little delirious too, because I was just underslept and overworked, if you will. And I thought, well, I could kiss her right now. And then, well, I could also get fired for kissing a nursing technician on my first week as a resident, so I better not. And we would chat when I saw her on the nursing unit. And then about a year and a half later, she had finished nursing school and she'd taken a job as a nurse on that same unit. And she said hi to me, and we started chatting. I was more senior resident at this point, and I was single, and it turns out she was single. And so we started dating and got married 2 years later. And
did you get married while she was still in your residency?
I did. I got married during my research time in the residency. It's common to either get married early in residency, have kids when you're in research, or get married in research and have kids late.
And I think you told me that, you know, with tremendous foresight, you decided to delay having kids.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time talking about it and figuring out what would be best. And one of my concerns was having kids while I'm meant to be fully engrossed in the training program. And the training programs have hour restrictions, but the reality is you're not home as much as I wasn't going to be home as much as I'd like to be if I was a parent, especially a new parent. And if we moved to a residency fellowship program like we did, then Cheryl would be stuck in a city without any social support with kids, and I'd be gone for long hours and not able to be a supportive father, and she'd be alone. And so we decided that we would wait until I was done with my training to have kids. So we waited until I was a first-year faculty member to start having kids.
Okay. And then my other favorite thing about Hopkins, which still blows my mind, is the whole left-handed, right-handed thing.
Yeah.
So let's explain that one, because you're left-handed, right?
I'm left-handed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like 15% of the population, and maybe 20% of surgeons.
Really? But you told me that in Hopkins, it's like, you know, it's shameful to be left-handed.
Well, it wasn't shameful, but it was a very traditional program at the time. And it was preferred by the surgeons that you were operating with not to operate left-handed, because they don't want a mirror image opposite the table. They want the right hand and left hand, you know, the left hand, the right hand, and the right hand of the two surgeons opposite each other to be facing each other. So as a trainee, the left-handed surgeons had to learn how to operate right-handed. And so I did most of my residency operating right-handed. And what would happen is when the attending surgeon was in the room and I was operating with him, I'd operate right-handed. Some of the younger surgeons or more progressive surgeons were willing to let me operate left-handed. And then if there were parts of the operation where they weren't there, like closing the skin while they were writing the orders or dictating notes, what have you, I would switch over to left-handed because I'm faster left-handed. So it was a challenge because I had to learn how to do everything new for the first time backwards.
I love the idea of like, when no one's looking, I'm just going to switch back to being left-handed.
Well, I'd ask some of the surgeons if I could do the operation left-handed, and some would be very reasonable and willing, and some would say, no, do it right-handed.
Wow. And then what do you, now that you're a big old boss, when you have your trainees, do you force them to do one way or the other?
Absolutely not. I don't want them to do something that they're not using their down and hand for. I want them to be as good as they can be. For a while, I thought maybe when I'm an attending, I'll have the surgical residents all operate left-handed. Doesn't make any sense.
Just to get your own back.
You don't have a pitcher for a professional baseball team pitching with their non-dominant hand just because.
Yeah, it's right? Crazy.
So you
and Cheryl, you're in Seattle. And how long is that fellowship for?
That was a 2-year fellowship.
Okay. And what was Cheryl doing during that time?
Cheryl, so she was, she's, I'll tell you, she's an incredibly self-motivated person. I'm fortunate to have not fallen far from the tree, if you will, with my parents and my sister. All between my parents and my sister, everyone has a doctorate. My dad has a PhD and MD. My mom is an MD and my sister's a PhD. My wife grew up in much more humble and non-academic environment. Similarly, went to public schools like I did, and then also went to university. And when she was a nurse at Johns Hopkins, she realized a great step forward in her career, getting a master's in nursing to become a nurse practitioner. So she became a nurse practitioner when I was in residency, after she'd been a floor nurse for a few years and had a good amount of experience. And then she was an inpatient nurse practitioner on the surgical oncology service and perfected her inpatient care delivery. And then when I was in Seattle and she was with me in Seattle and I was gone long hours, she did a doctorate in nursing at the University of Washington. And so she has a doctorate in nursing, which is a clinical doctorate, not like a PhD. Then when we were looking at positions around the country for jobs, ultimately that allowed her to pursue an academic track. She's actually pursue a university track. So she's actually a clinical professor of surgery. She's the first non-MD or PhD full professor in the School of Medicine at the University of Colorado, which I couldn't be more proud. And then she also went to do a master's in business administration. She's an MBA. So she has one more degree than me is an outstanding clinician and leader in her own right.
That's fantastic. Okay, so you do your 2 years in Seattle.
Yeah.
And now it's the big moment. It's like, yeah. You know.
Now I'm looking for a job.
A real job that could be a job for life.
You know, yeah, it could be a job for life. And then the last time I had a real job that wasn't a trainee was when I was serving ice cream at Friendly's, which is a chain restaurant in New England.
There you go.
Right.
So, Pierre, you didn't put that on your CV.
That's not my CV. Here I am in my 30s, in my mid-30s, looking for a job. And I was looking around the country. I was looking at academic thoracic jobs, so at a university hospital, trying to figure out what was going to be a good fit for me and my family, and hopefully for many years. Traditionally, there's actually a 30% turnover in academic medicine every year. And so the typical academic job, at least in surgery, is 3 years before you go somewhere else. And
really? That's surprising. So it's not a job for life. So for 30% of people, they move around or they switch to do something else.
Within the first year.
Wow.
And so I was looking at positions and I wanted to stay as far west as we could because I loved the experience we were having in Seattle and my youth in the West Coast. And my wife wanted to get back as far east as she could to be as close to her family, understandably.
Where's Cheryl's family from?
She's from New Jersey, from southern New Jersey, outside of Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. So I was looking at positions, and the opportunity came up for as a thoracic surgeon at the University of Colorado Hospital and the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And I was intrigued by it, and it was a happy medium between staying west and having a West Coast environment and going back to the East Coast. There are plenty of direct flights to the East Coast from the hub that United has made here in Denver. And as I started to look, and it has a world-renowned thoracic and cardiac surgical faculty, and as I was looking at this program, it became apparent that there was not a chief of surgery at the time. And the chair of surgery is critically important because cardiothoracic surgery falls within the department of surgery, and the chair of surgery is the person who's helping guide the ship. And so I started to inquire as to who's being considered for potential chair options. And two of the chair potential candidates on the short list of candidates were the then current cardiothoracic surgery chair, David Fullerton, who was a world-renowned cardiothoracic surgeon who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago from cancer, and Richard Schulich, who was a surgical oncologist from Johns Hopkins and a hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgeon, also world-renowned. And I had worked with Rich my very first operation, my first day of internship, July 1st, 2002, was with Richard Schulich. My last abdominal cancer operation as a general surgery resident was a distal pancreatectomy with Richard Schulich. I'd known him for years. And Cheryl had been the nurse practitioner working on his inpatient service when I was a resident.
Wow.
So it was like, this is a really good coincidence and potentially a great opportunity. So I called him up. Like, hey, Dr. Schulich, it's Robin. We haven't talked in a while. I'm finishing up my training. I'm looking at jobs. There's a thoracic surgery position at the University of Colorado. You need to take it. This is going to be an incredible experience. I said, well, are you there? He's like, no. I've accepted the job. I start in a few months. There's a huge opportunity to build an outstanding program. The School of Medicine's amazing. The environmental resource, the resources there are amazing. If you build it, they will come and please join me. And that to me was the cherry on top of the opportunity.
Yeah.
Of coming out to an environment where I was in a growing environment. And you've been here. Ross, when did you come to University of Colorado?
2005.
So you've been here for all this growth.
Yeah.
And relocation of the hospital to the Anschutz campus. And I came out here for a job interview. I left Seattle. It was cloudy. I got here. It was blazingly bright. I forgot my sunglasses because I didn't carry them in Seattle. And I come to this brand new campus. It had only been open a year. And it's like, this is the research, one research field, another research field. And there's the School of Medicine, the nursing school. Here's the hospital. Here's the cancer center. It's like, wow, this is amazing.
And that was what, 2012?
Yeah, I took the job in 2012, but I first came out in 2011 to interview. And it was December and it was still beautiful. And so after my first visit, I got home back to Seattle and I said, Cheryl, we got to go out there. You've got to come with me. Well, I don't have a job there. You're an outstanding, successful person. You'll find a position. And so she and I came back for a second interview. She loved it too. When I took the faculty position, she was interviewed and they said to her, well, she said, what's the opportunity for a promotion? And they said, well, you're going to be an instructor because you're a nurse practitioner. She said, well, I have a doctorate of nursing. Someone hadn't read the CV.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, well, then you can get in the faculty track. And here she is, a full professor.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I that's so Cheryl to just go, you know, oh, and by the way, you know.
Yeah, she's a wonderful person. She, I mean, as you've seen her grow the programs, my wife helped develop and runs and oversees all of the multidisciplinary cancer programs in the Cancer Center, which are about 13, 14, 15 programs overseeing streamlined multidisciplinary care delivery for cancer patients. And those had been a game changer as a thoracic surgeon. I was in our esophageal and gastric multidisciplinary cancer clinic this morning, seeing complex patients. We've actually expanded that to benign patients. Our lung multidisciplinary clinic on Monday, I saw 5 or 6 patients with cancer, and we've got the streamlined delivery of care, it is a game changer. It's what I'd want if I was in their situation.
When you came here, 2012, mm-hmm. how many thoracic surgeons were there then?
There were 2, John Mitchell and Michael Wyant, as I was the third partner. And unlike Seattle, which has multiple hospitals with over a dozen thoracic surgeons, I was about the 5th general thoracic surgeon or 6th general thoracic surgeon in the state of Colorado.
Wow.
Which is like, wow, there's a lot of opportunity for high quality care delivery to patients who haven't necessarily had high quality care available to them.
So how do you get patients? How do you build and personalize your practice?
Well, through our multidisciplinary programs, patients seek out our program in our center, as you know, yep. Which is really wonderful, especially that patients locally can have options they didn't previously have, and patients in the region can get high quality care that they may not have locally without having to travel to other states, East Coast, Texas, California. Meeting patient providers, discussing patient care opportunities with patient providers so they can understand what approach you're coming from and what you have to provide them have been really rewarding and have obviously led to further referrals. When I came here, my 2 senior partners at the time, they're still both practicing surgeons, John Mitchell being here and Michael Wyant being on the East Coast now, are outstanding surgeons, are outstanding technicians, great physicians and scientists. And so when I came here, I had to figure out what opportunities there were for me. And I started talking to other surgeons and talking to other providers and seeing the referrals that came through. And there were some niche opportunities that didn't exist because there just weren't enough providers in Colorado to specialize in them. And those have included sarcoma. As you know, the sarcoma program's grown by leaps and bounds and has its own multidisciplinary clinic.
So like chest wall sarcoma or sarcoma anywhere?
Sarcoma in general, but for me, it's sarcoma metastases to the lungs or chest wall sarcomas or primary lung sarcomas. And that's been a big growth for our institution. Being able to provide the supportive services for multidisciplinary programs such as colorectal cancer, gynecologic cancer, endocrine cancers, head and neck cancer have been great opportunities as our programs as an institution have grown and we've been able to be more cutting edge with the care delivery. When I showed up, there weren't surgeons in the state of Colorado doing adult pectus excavatum, which is pectus excavatum is an abnormal chest wall development where the chest is, the sternum's pushed inward, compressing the heart. And you can imagine if your heart's compressed, you can feel very short of breath. And if you're here at altitude, it makes it even worse. So I started seeing patients for that only because my partners were very busy with other disease processes and have developed a practice and I absolutely love it. It's relatively healthy patients who are relatively young, but of all ages, who have a correctable disease. That's a mechanical disease, that with correction live out their full life and are fortunate because they don't have to worry about cancer.
So what do you cut out their sternum?
No,
cut the ribs. What do you do?
Reposition their sternum. We elevate the sternum up off the heart and stabilize it there with titanium bars that stay in for 3 years as the body remodels around it. And it's a minimally invasive procedure and has excellent outcomes and has a great impact on patients' quality of life.
Okay, so here's did you learn that when you're training, or is this like you go, there's a gap in the market, and it was like, oh, you know, crap, who's going to teach me how to do this?
Yeah. So I learned the foundations in training, the general surgery training, and then the cardiothoracic training on top of it. You get a huge foundation in surgery.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing microvascular reanastomoses of free flaps like a plastic surgeon who's gone and done that as a specialty. But the foundations you get in all these surgical trainings build upon each other. And then your familiarity and comfort in operating different parts of the body and doing different things becomes higher and higher. And then in my training in Seattle, for instance, the 2 benign diseases that we did a fair amount of were pectus excavatum with an operation called a ravage procedure. That's an older procedure where you actually cut out cartilages. It's not the procedure I typically use today. And tracheal resection. So for cervical tracheal stenosis, where the airway is narrow, you can cut it out and reconstruct the trachea, sew the two ends back together again and alleviate the obstruction. So these are mechanical diseases with a great mechanical solution and wonderful outcomes. And So these are things that you see a little bit in training, and you do some in training. And then when you get into practice, you start saying, well, am I comfortable doing that? Yeah. Am I safe doing that? Yeah. I went down to watch Don Jaruzelski, who's an outstanding surgeon in Phoenix area. And I watched Dr. Jaruzelski do NUS procedures, which is the name of the procedure we use to elevate the sternum off the chest without cutting all the cartilages. And then I went to shadow one of our pediatric surgeons. He does a fair number of them, named David Partrick at Children's Hospital. And then he came and watched me to make sure I was doing them safely. And then when everyone was happy, I then proceeded to do them safely. And I've been doing them for 12 of the last 14 years. And so learning new techniques is a challenge. So with robotic surgery, so about the majority of my cancer operations on lungs are robotic. I did the very first, I was the assistant to Michael Mulligan doing the very first robotic lung resection at the University of Washington, my last day of fellowship.
Wow.
So I got to see one, but I certainly wasn't in a position to do one or teach one. To back to your adage, see one, do one, teach one. And in 2019, my partners and I all embarked upon the process of retraining to do robotic thoracic surgery. And so there's simulations that you do and computer simulations, and there's educational modules that you do to learn about things. And then there's going to do hands-on labs in non-humans, so plastic models or in animal models, or cadaveric trainings that we all did to get proficiency in robotic techniques. And then you spend all that time talking to colleagues around the country and getting tips and tricks from them and reading manuscripts and looking at videos online. And then you go and watch some master surgeons do these operations and observe them and ask them questions and have them give you feedback. And then they come and watch you and they proctor you doing them. And then everyone agrees that you're safe to do it when you've reached a certain proficiency and the hospital has signed off on it and the safety protocols have all been checked. And then you start doing them. And then you start out very logically of taking small operations and doing high repetitions of smaller, simpler operations before you add more complex surgery to get to the point where you can do multiple complex operations in a single day without having issues or having complications or, well, you know. And so it's definitely a graduated process. It's a really neat process, but it's important so that we can all continue to be cutting edge. Just like you as an oncologist, the advent of immunotherapy.
Yeah. I mean, we learn it, but it's more of an, I can learn mine by reading something. I don't have to have somebody physically watch me do it.
Yeah, but you go to meetings and you hear about it and you talk to colleagues and you ask about it and you talk about what are the side effects. So when you're talking to a patient for the first time about it, you're not saying, well, I don't know, let me look it up.
Yeah. Hold on, let's Google that together. And so that's never a great line. The when people do that, I mean, it is actually tremendously collegial when you describe it like that, that people come and they watch you. Yeah. Are they just doing this, you know, out of the goodness of their heart? Is it, you know?
No, I mean, the people who are training you have contracts with the device companies to proctor you so that they're getting compensation for it as well, because it's an encumbrance. They can't be as efficient as they could if I'm sitting there over their shoulder asking questions the whole time.
So things are going great. You know, you're building your practice. And then I want to touch on what happened in 2017.
Yeah.
On your Australian vacation.
Yeah. So 2017. So I had 2 weeks consecutively between Christmas and New Year's, which is an unusually large amount of vacation as a faculty member. And with my partners covering my patients. And so we planned a trip to Australia. One of my cousins from England has relocated to Australia and settled there and has a family and we never see him. And there are all sorts of incredible things in Australia to see, right? So we planned a trip where we were going to spend a few days with my cousin in Melbourne, and then we were going to fly to a place called Kangaroo Island, which is a small island off the south coast of Adelaide in the south of Australia, where there's all these nature preserves, and there's wild colonies of animals, and you can see koalas in the nature, and you can see kangaroos and wallabies in the nature, etc. So we go there, we spend some time with my cousin, we move on and we fly to Kangaroo Island. We have a little rental apartment, Airbnb type of place. Cheryl, my then almost one-year-old son, and my almost four-year-old daughter. And I must have gotten a cold from my son because he had a snotty nose.
Sure.
Or I got it from somewhere. Human metapneumovirus, which is a common cold. And I also must have walked through a sneeze cloud of someone or touched a doorknob of something at the airport or something. On December 23rd, I start feeling a little crummy, feel like a cold's coming on. And I'm coughing. So in our little two-room rental apartment, my wife slept in the second room with my kids because I was coughing too much. She was disturbing it. And as the sun rose and I started to wake up and come alert on December 24th around sunrise, around 5:30 or 6 a.m., I look around the room and the floor is littered with blood-covered tissues. And I've been coughing up mucus, but it's been bloody all night long. And I cannot take a deep breath. I can't even call out to my wife. I can't even raise enough volume in my lungs to call out to my wife. So I climb off the bed onto the floor and I climb up to the wall that's separating the rooms and start kicking the wall and banging on the wall to get her attention. She comes in, is horrified, helps me get some clothes on and put a shirt and shorts on and get out to the car, and I actually crawled out to the rental car. I couldn't stand up to walk. I couldn't breathe enough to take a deep breath to walk. She packages the kids in the back seat in their car seats, and she drives up. It's the first time she'd driven on the opposite side of the road. She drives up the one lane asphalt road from south to north of Kangaroo Island to the hospital, which she's also found out where it is. And it's a two-room hospital. It's around 6:30 in the morning. And I climb up the steps to the front door, and a gentleman asks if he can help me. And I say to him, look, I can't breathe. I can't feel my fingers or my toes. I'm in shock. I'm a physician in the U.S. Can you help me? And then he was the nurse. He was on a nursing, they just changed shifts. He got me onto a stretcher. The physician lived nearby, got there very quickly. They did rapid sequent induction and intubated me before I went to sleep with a breathing tube. They told me that I was in septic shock. I had elevated abnormal labs that shouldn't be elevated. I had depressed normal labs, elevated abnormal labs that shouldn't be depressed. I was in renal failure, and I was put to sleep, breathing tube put in, helicoptered to the University of Adelaide in Adelaide, Australia, and was in their ICU. And my poor wife had to pack up the vacation and get a rental car and kids and all our belongings at the beginning of a two-week trip to a hospital in Adelaide, which was a feat in its own that I obviously wasn't part of helping. And then I had septic shock. I had a group A strep pneumonia, human metapneumovirus superimposed on that. I had fulminant septic shock with respiratory failure, pulmonary edema, acute renal failure, was started on dialysis on a ventilator, treated with broad spectrum antibiotics and supported. I was briefly extubated for one day on December 31st, watched the fireworks on the TV. We were meant to be watching them from Sydney Harbor, but watched them on the TV. And then the next morning got reintubated for persistent respiratory failure. My son learned to walk while I was unconscious. And they kept me alive. They got me better. The ICU team did a phenomenal job. After a couple of weeks, I had a tracheostomy. I was life-flighted back to the University of Colorado to my own intensive care unit where my partners cared for me.
Wow.
So obviously it was a traumatic experience. I was discharged at the beginning of February, having lost 35 pounds of muscle mass. I couldn't stand on my own. I was discharged to inpatient rehabilitation for physical therapy to regain enough strength to stand. I had a tremor from loss of muscle mass in my arms. I initially couldn't hold my arms up against gravity. I'm thinking, am I ever going to be a surgeon again? Am I going to be a father?
Yeah.
No. Am I going to be able to make it? And then spent the first quarter of the calendar year of 2018 doing outpatient physical therapy, doing as much physical therapy as I could tolerate at home, regaining strength and muscle mass. And thankfully, I didn't have any unrecoverable injuries or illnesses.
Yeah, because it wasn't neurological. It was just, you know.
No neurologic defects.
Yeah.
It was physical and it was organ failure, and those have all thankfully recovered.
Wow. How long were you on a ventilator for total?
I think it was about 3 weeks.
And what were those 3 weeks like? Are you conscious?
I was in and out of consciousness on medications, mostly, largely when I was in Australia, except for 24 hours, I was unconscious and have distinct recollections, but nothing in between, just blackness, not passage of time, just blackness.
Yeah.
And when I was in Denver, I was less sedated. I had recovered much more and didn't need to be on paralysis on the ventilator and on nitric oxide. I could be on less aggressive vent settings and less supportive settings, so I could breathe on my own and regain muscle strength for respiratory muscles. And that encounter was a lot of blurring of day and night and what's real and what's memories. And I have vivid dreams that I know are nightmares because they weren't real at all. And a lot of reorienting by my family to what was real.
Yeah.
And thankfully my family was all helpful and supportive and there to take care of me. And the nursing staff who I take care of my own patients before and since are the same team who took care of me. It was phenomenal. And my partners took care of me. And I was fortunate to be the benefit of a lot of medical supportive care.
Yeah.
And also otherwise healthy and young and able to recover with a lot of support.
I mean, I love the idea of your own team catching you.
Yeah.
And getting you back to life, literally.
Yeah, they did.
So for that period of time, when you're conscious, but you can't talk because you're intubated. I mean, what did your brain do?
Well, I started doing math problems because I was afraid I was not going to be able to get back to logical function. So I would do simple math, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division in my head to make sure things were still working.
Yeah.
And then while this was going on, I had been running a clinical trial where we were examining patient reported outcomes after surgery and risk assessment, which is my research is on risk assessment, risk adjustment, and risk analysis for surgical risk. So we were still doing that. And when I got home, and I'm doing physical therapy during the day, but I can't operate yet because I don't have the strength to, I started re-engaging with my research team, my research partners and collaborators of many years, and having them update me on our work, that the trial that was ongoing and the patient reported outcome results, and was able to really delve into that once again, because although I couldn't stand up long enough to do an operation, my brain worked. And so I could re-engage in that academic love, which I've always had, and continue to develop that so that when I came back to work, the research kept moving.
Did you contemplate the idea that you wouldn't recover?
I was afraid of that. Yeah.
How did you process that?
Well, I had a lot and have a lot to live for. And I recognized that my intellectual faculties were intact and that it was deconditioning of my extremities, I could recondition, and with great support from our physical medicine and rehabilitation faculty and our physical therapy faculty, did that so that I could have a goal. And as I started progressing through the physical therapy, my partners and I picked a goal for returning to work and resuming my clinical duties. And my physical medicine rehabilitation physician, Nathan Odom, who's a faculty member still here, met with me and would do exams of me and make sure I was regaining strength and able to use all my hands and legs.
I mean, it's funny. We talked right at the beginning about you remembering your very first operation as a medical student on a keloid scar. Do you remember the first time you operated after recovering from this?
Yeah, actually, I scrubbed into one of my partner's operations. He was doing a pneumonectomy, so taking out the entirety of a right lung, I think right or left, with one of our cardiothoracic surgery fellows. And I scrubbed in not to operate, not to actually do the operation, anything at all, but just to be there and make sure I could stand up and assist. So I did it like an assistant, like I did when I was a resident, where I was retracting and holding instruments, and just to make sure that things were going to work.
And then when did you do your first operation on your own? Or did you have someone looking over your shoulder when you did it? Was it like retraining again, in a sense?
No, it wasn't. I mean, because it wasn't like I lost the ability to do it. I hadn't lost the cognitive ability to do it. I just had lost the muscle mass. But I think one of my partners probably watched me operate in my first operation, and I kept it simple, simple operation.
And, wow.
You know, and then rebuilt up to full length days and things like that.
So I've got, people always ask me this about my own diagnosis. Like, how did that experience change you as a person or as a physician?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. It's hard to answer that. And it's hard to answer that concisely and comprehensively. It reinforced to me that you have no idea what the person in front of you has gone through.
Yeah.
Just looking at them doesn't tell you their story. You don't know what barriers they've overcome. You don't know what barriers they're subjected to. You don't know what their preferences and beliefs are. And it reinforces to me something I was taught in medical school, that as physicians, we're here to provide opportunities to the patient and help guide a patient's care, but not make decisions for that patient, right? So I'm not here to tell you to have surgery. I'm here that if you need surgery, I can do it for you safely and do my best to ensure you have a great outcome. But I'm here to educate you so you can make a decision as to what you want for your care. That's how I see that.
And do you think you do that in a different way, given your experiences?
I hope it's improved my empathy.
Okay. I think this might, even though it's a painful memory, I do think it's probably a great one to end on. As I said at the beginning, you are an inspiration to me. I mean, I don't think I've ever told you that, but you know, that grit of just putting one foot in front of the other, especially when it takes tremendous effort, that's what we can all aspire to. Rob, thanks for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with hosts, me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.